Senate Resource Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 17th, 2023. The time is 3:04 p.m. Please silence all phones. Present today, Co-Chair Geisel, Senator Dunbar. Good afternoon, Senator Kawasaki. Welcome, Senators Klayman and Senators Willikowski will be along, as well as Senator Kaufman. They're on other state business. Thanks to our support staff, Carrie Cooper-Ryder and Amanda Kraft behind the curtain. And today's agenda will be the first hearing of SB 72, National Resource Water Nomination / Designation, sponsored by Senator Geisel. And then we're going to have a heavy oil recovery by Dr. Dandekar from the University of Alaska. We'll change, take a brief at ease at the end of this presentation, and then pass the gavel to Co-Chair Geisel. Senator Kaufman, welcome. Okay, Senator Geisel, we're at this point in time for the National Reservation Resource Water nominations, and your staff, Julie O'Connor, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Geisel. I'm the Senator for Senate District E, as an echo, that's in Anchorage. Today, the bill before you is Senate Bill 72. The title on the bill is National Resource Water Nomination / Designation. A lot of people know this as Tier 3 waters. This is not a new subject, though I know that there are members on this committee that are new to the committee and may not have heard or be familiar with this this topic, but it actually was a topic back in 2016, and in 2019 another bill was offered, and today we have another one. All attempting to do the same thing. Next slide. So, what, first of all, are we attempting to do? The purpose of this bill is to give the legislature the authority to designate a water as Tier 3. Tier 3 is also known as Outstanding National Resource Waters, or ONWR. So what are these? Next slide. They are a part of the Clean Water Act. So in 1948, we first heard of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. In 1972, this was expanded to what we know today as the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act mandated that states implement a water quality-based control program known as water quality standards. And those were to be established by 1983. The water quality standards must include designated use classifications, numerical and/or narrative water quality criteria, an anti-degradation policy, and that policy required states at a minimum to have provisions for management of water quality in a tier system. So, next slide. If you will take a look in your documents, you have a document that's called Developing a Tier 3 Water Nomination and Designated Process in Alaska. And this one happens to be the outreach report. The report is dated September 1, 2017. And on page 4 of that document, you'll see what's on the screen right now. So page 4 is where this graphic that you see on the screen comes from. These are the three tiers of water quality. So tier 1 is basically the floor, existing quality of the water as it exists now. These are waters that are not currently meeting water quality standards for one or more parameters. So typically it's because people live along the waters, they've got docks in them, they've got boats they drive up and down. Maybe there's agriculture along the river. So all of these are putting elements into the water that don't meet a standard of unpolluted water, let's say. Tier 2 quality is a high-quality water. These are the vast majority of the waters in Alaska. These waters are fishable and swimmable. So there are other elements in the water, but it's not a threat to humans. Tier 3 is what we're talking about today, outstanding national resource waters. And these are a special class of water deserving special protection. They are the highest level of protection under the anti-degradation policy that the Water Quality Act calls out. Next slide. So this is what we're talking about here. Where high quality waters constitute an outstanding national resource, such as waters of the national and state parks and wildlife refuges and waters of exceptional recreation or ecological significance, that water quality must be maintained and perfected. So a lot of people say, well, these are pristine waters. They don't have any development of any kind along them, no pollution in them, and if they are designated a Tier 3 water, no degradation will be allowed. Next page, please. So every state is required to institute these tiered waters. And right now, our Department of Environmental Conservation has a policy in place that identifies how this is done. And you have that document also. And it looks like this in your binder. It's among all the documents you were given. State of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Policy and Procedure. Guidance relating to the nomination and designation of Tier 3 waters. So it's got a big blue box on it. You will see in that policy on page 2 of 2, it's a very short policy, the current process that DEC, our Department of Environmental Conservation, uses or has in place related to the designation of these waters. So nominations are sent in. They propose that certain waters would be designated. We'll look at those waters later. And then right now, the policy states that this will go to the legislature. The problem that this bill is attempting to address is the fact that this is a policy, not a law. So at this point, the implementation of that policy is in the hands of the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. The bill attempts to clarify, to codify, that it's actually in the hands of the legislature. Next slide, please. So what are we talking about concerning where these waters might be? There are five requests that have been submitted, and you see them there on the screen. And in your supplemental material, you will have the actual submissions. They are letters from, for example, this is for the Chilkat River, from the Chilkat Indian Village, asking for that designation. And that's down in the Haines area there on the map. Yeah, right down there, just north of us here in Juneau. But you'll see the requests from all five of these in your packet. So these are submitted to the Department of Environmental Conservation. What the bill proposes to do is that these requests be, or these nominations be submitted to the legislature, and the legislature to review them and determine whether they appropriately be designated. Next slide. So our Constitution says in Article 8, Section 2, my favorite article, because it pertains to natural resources, the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people. So water is obviously called out here as one of our natural resources. Next slide. And we have in Section 13, also Article 8, a specific constitutional statement related to water. All surface and subsurface waters reserved to the people for common use, except mineral and medicinal waters, are subject to appropriation. Priority of appropriation shall give prior right, except for public water supply, an appropriation of water shall be limited to stated purposes and subject preferences among beneficial uses, concurrent or otherwise, as prescribed by law, and to the general reservation of fish and wildlife. So you see the word appropriation in there. So appropriation of resources, appropriation of assets of the state is the purview of the legislature. This was underscored when the Alaska Supreme Court heard the case Malott versus Stand for Salmon. The question before the court at that time is, could an initiative be used to designate a body of water in the state as a Tier 3 water? The court said that an initiative designating a Tier 3 water would override the legislature's power to make decisions concerning the allocation of state assets, and that the legislature has the ultimate decision-making authority to use specific public assets for specific purposes. So essentially underscoring that it is the legislature that should have jurisdiction over these designations. Last page. So in summary, that's what Senate Bill 72 does. It codifies that the current policy of the Department of Environmental Conservation be implemented as law, allowing the legislature, recognizing the legislature's authority to appropriate the waters into a Tier 3 status. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions. We also have, of course, expert testimony available in the form of Randy Bates, who will also speak to the bill.
I'd like to recognize Senator Wilikowski has joined us. And you've got a big sectional here. You want to do that real quick before we bring Mr. Bates up?
Ms. O'Connor can do the sectional. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then we'll bring Mr. Bates. I have a Mr. Bates question.
For the record, my name is Julia O'Connor, staff to Senator Giesel. I will be walking you through our sectional analysis for SB 72. Section 1 amends AS 46.03 by adding a new section that establishes AS 46.03.085 subsection A. Through statute, the legislature may designate a water of the state as an outstanding national resource water. And subsection B, unless the body of water has been designated as an outstanding national resource water, can it be managed like so? Section 2 applies for an immediate effective date. Thank you.
Any questions on the sectional? Seeing none, Mr. Dunbar.
No, it's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bates, would you join us at the table? Your trusty aide there, too, if you need a lifeline.
Good afternoon. For the record, Randy Bates, Director of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill and having the department present today. Senator Giesel, thank you so much for introducing this bill and putting together such a comprehensive packet of information and walkthrough as you just did. The department is here to express our support for this bill, and with the committee's indulgence, I'll provide a few more remarks along the lines of how this would be implemented and the importance of Tier 3 waters, as well as the bill as it's structured for you. As Senator Giesel clarified, outstanding natural resource waters, ONRWs, or Mr. Chair, can we, Tier 3, if it's probably easier to say than ONRWs or even the longer version of it. So Tier 3s, they are defined as waters of exceptional recreational or ecological significance, which shall be maintained and protected from degradation in perpetuity. Tier 3 designation of a water body bestows the highest level of water quality protections under the Federal Clean Water Act, and it restricts a wide range of uses along those waters as well as on the adjacent lands. Since, as Senator Giesel mentioned, since 1983, the Clean Water Act has required that each state establish a Tier 3 designation process. DEC did that in November of 2018 through that policy and procedure document that she referenced. It's in your packet. That is what is the current process in place. Because the designation of a Tier 3 water body carries with it the requirement to maintain and protect water quality from degradation, that has broad implications and ramifications on activities that may occur either in or adjacent to those designated areas. Things like road and building construction, seafood processing locations, recreational activities, municipal wastewater discharge treatment facilities, stormwater discharge, landfills, gravel quarries, just everything that you can imagine that a municipality or an area or a development may engage in is going to be restricted, potentially restricted, if they're going to have a contribution of degradation or impact to that Tier 3 water body. Designation of that Tier 3 water body requires that the water quality on that designated body be maintained and protected for the reasons designated and for the water quality at the time of designation, right? So that's important to recognize as well. What this practically means is that there will be no new or increased discharges allowed that would either go into that Tier 3 water body or upstream of it that would then impact that Tier 3 water body. This would potentially eliminate, as I mentioned, some of those road improvements in the area, increased or changed discharges from municipal wastewater, increased recreational opportunities. So it has a very chilling effect, a very significant restriction opportunity on those water bodies. Here's the important part. Such widespread impacts make a Tier 3 designation a de facto land and water use decision, one that may be based on designation criteria and use restriction that is well outside the department's expertise and authority. So we are supportive of the bill as it's written that formalizes the designation of Tier 3 water by the legislature through statutes for three very important reasons. First, the legislative process provides a full and public process engaging all of the interested and affected parties, including those communities, residents, users, developers, and conservationists, and also those agencies with oversight authorities and responsibilities for the area, lands, and waters, including our sister agencies. Number two, the legislative process allows for a full discussion of the consequences, restrictions, or impacts to other activities and potential activities by the designation, including future and foreseeable activities. And the third reason, this legislative body and the process is the proper forum to establish land and water use designations, and we are pleased to return that power to this body in this instance. Providing designation of a Tier 3 water body as structured in the bill will bring certainty and it will bring predictability and a consistent practice for how lands and waters across the state would be designated for conservation by legislative approval rather than by a division, by a department, or by judicial discretion. For those reasons, as I mentioned, the department is here to express support for the bill as it's written. I thank you for inviting me to testify. I'm happy to answer questions as I'm here.
Senator Dunbar.
Apologies, Mr. Chairman.
None needed.
So a couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Bates. So are there any other states that use a regulatory rather than legislative process to designate these waters?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, the answer is yes. There is a wide variety of how states do this. Some states do it legislatively. Some states do it regulatorily. Some states do it by a body, a commission, or by a commissioner. I was recently talking with Idaho. I was just down working with the other states, and Idaho is an example of a similar process to us, which is a similar process to what's proposed in the bill, which is a legislative process.
Can I ask a couple follow-ups, Mr. Chair? So this is a new issue and novel to me. So other states, similar states do it by regulation. For example, in the documents provided, Arizona, I think, had designated 21 of these Tier 3 waters through the regulatory process. So a couple of questions. Could now, if the legislature decided, you know, I think the Chilcat, for example, was one of the waters, could the legislature now, even without a recommendation from you, could the legislature on our own designate that water as Tier 3?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, the answer is yes. The policy that we set up directs proponents to the legislature to do that. Were you to designate a Tier 3 water body, we would manage it accordingly.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
So
the only thing I just want to say to the committee, at 4 o'clock we're going to bring up Dr. Dandekar from Fairbanks, and this is a great subject. We're not cutting anybody off. And we can come back and pick this up at our next meeting. So I just don't want to be rude to my committee members, but that's just kind of scheduled here today.
I'll try to be quick. So that's a little bit different than the question I asked. If you didn't have that regulatory that process identified in your department, mm-hmm. division rather, could we still do this? Would the EPA prevent us from designating that or making that designation to them if you didn't have that policy in place? Or the legislature sort of inherently has that power to do it?
Yeah. Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I'm going to follow up with you in writing on that. My expectation and understanding is the answer is yes, you could do that. But I want to confirm that legally, because we have a process in place that has been reviewed by EPA, and I want to make sure that were a constituent of yours to approach you and ask for that designation now or in the absence of that policy, that you'd be able to provide that. I'm confident the answer is yes. I just want to follow up and confirm that in writing.
I think so, too. And so what that the conclusion that leads me to is that this legislation doesn't give us any new power to designate Tier 3. But what it does is restricts a future division or department from establishing that regulatory system and maybe doing it themselves without the legislature, and thus probably makes any designation of Tier 3 less likely in the future.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I was with you until you said to reduce the likelihood of Tier 3s. That can occur. We're the will of the body to do so.
Right. Just make sure that only we can do it as opposed to us or you.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Oh, can I ask my question, because it's right in behind where he's going? It might shed some clarity on where you're going. So right now, you got 5 people that are applying as individual groups. Is the onus and the burden of proof on if that's a Tier 3 designation, that is that on them to prove that to you?
Senator Bishop, Mr. Chair, the answer is yes.
And if it's in the legislature's ballpark, then it's on us?
Senator Bishop, Mr. Chair, that would still – the onus of information is still on the proponent. So if somebody is going to propose to Senator Dunbar – a Tier 3 water body, my expectation and yours should be, prove it. Show me the data. Give me all of the information that you have. Make the compelling case. And if it meets my test, your test, then you would sponsor it as a bill.
Senator Kawasaki? Senator Klayman?
First, there's the 5 different water bodies that were on the map. And my understanding is that Those are applications that were submitted to DEC.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, the answer is yes. They were submitted at various times. We did respond to each one of those proponents and articulated what the path forward is.
Follow up. Have any of these been approved? I'm sure the first one was submitted in 2009 approximately.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, the answer is no. We did respond to each of those proponents with a letter saying this is a process you could and should follow to pursue the designation of a Tier 3 water body. And that was based on the establishment of our DEC policy and procedure on that.
Which is the follow-up? That's the 2017 policy. The effective date is 2018.
November 2018, through the chair.
So follow-up. So right now today, if I'm an entity that wants to nominate a Tier 3 water, essentially, they apply to DEC, and DEC says, this policy basically says, here's our policy. You have to go to the legislature to nominate the water body, right?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, the answer is yes, correct.
Okay.
We would direct them to you as a body. Generally, and this is within the policy, we would encourage the proponent to seek out their legislator, either on the House or the Senate side.
But a couple more, I think. But the basic answer is DEC has no policy day where DEC on its own will approve a nomination. DEC basically says, that's interesting paperwork you just gave us. Now go to the legislature today and see what they want to do.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, the answer is yes, we would direct them to the legislature to evaluate that.
Senator Klayman, let me jump in here with you on this little tag team. But the big but is, how much does it cost to do the science to bring the designation forward for the legislature? That's no easy hurdle.
Senator Bishop, I'd be happy to dig through my files here, because we had this very question last year, and in writing I did respond to you about that cost. I will,
that's fine.
After this, I will provide a response. I will provide our letter from last year, which would be, it would be the same answer this year. There is going to be a cost to anybody that proposes a Tier 3 water body, and the idea is, if there is a special water body, and there is increased coverage that is needed on that water body, there should be some effort put in to identify what the existing water quality criteria are, so that we as a state agency vested with the protection of human health and the environment and the implementation of water quality standards knows exactly how and why we are managing that water body as a Tier 3, so that there is no degradation or impact to that to the water quality and the reasons for that designation.
Senator Klayman?
I'll pass for I see Senator.
Senator Willikowski.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is the legislature has delegated to DEC the authority to develop clean water quality standards and classify waters. And my understanding is that anti-degradation is part of that authority. Is that correct?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, the answer is yes. As part of the delegated authority or primacy for under the Clean Water Act, we identify designated uses, we establish water quality standards, and we develop and implement an anti-degradation policy. Within that anti-deg policy, which Senator Giesel included in your packet, we have a process for Tier 1 waters, an anti-deg process for Tier 1 waters, Tier 2 waters, and Tier 3 waters.
Mr. Chair. And so the policy is essentially now on Tier 3, you send them to the legislature, you say go get legislative approval, which is what this bill would do. But I guess just maybe a philosophical question, is it better, would we rather have these designations made based on science, based on an agency review, based on what's scientifically best for the water, the river, or based on a political decision? What I'm hearing from you is it's better a political decision.
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, it is a fundamental discussion. I think that science can and will prevail in this body when presented with those facts. And I think that
very optimistic.
I understand my optimism is pervasive. Thank you for recognizing that. But the reasons for designation are also important to recognize. It's not just water quality based. It can include recreation, subsistence, other reasons beyond just it has incredible compliance with water quality standards. Or, I mean, it actually can be hot tub waters. I think I've used this example previously. It could be water that comes out geothermally at 105 degrees, and there's a reason that we want to maintain that, so there shouldn't be impacts. So it's interesting. I think it takes the expanded view of what Tier 3 waters are, and it puts it in what I believe and what the department believes is the proper form, being this body, as a land use, water use designation, similar to critical habitat areas and other type of areas that have significant restrictions on uses.
Thank you. We're going to go to our invited testimony now. And I apologize. This is a very good subject. It's going to come back up before us. We're going to go to our invited testimony now, Layla Kimbrell, Executive Director, Resource Development Council for Alaska. And Layla, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, and please put yourself on the record in 3 minutes, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Layla Kimbrell, Executive Director for the Resource Development Council for Alaska, or RDC. Very briefly, RDC for 47 years has advocated for a strong, diversified private sector in Alaska and to expand the state's economic base through the responsible development of our natural resources. We are a statewide trade association comprised of individuals and companies from Alaska's fishing, tourism, forestry, mining, and oil and gas industries. We collaborate with our partners and policymakers to ensure Alaska continues to have a strong and diverse economy through the responsible development of our resources. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide invited testimony today on the Tier 3 Waters Bill, SB 72. Without being repetitive and understanding the time constraints of the committee schedule today, I would just put that that RDC agrees with the characterization of the Tier 3 Waters as described by Senator Diesel and by Mr. Bates from DEC. For the following reasons, RDC speaks in support of this bill, and because it provides a clean solution to complying with the EPA requirements to codify state agency policy related to Tier 3 water. Tier 3 designation are required to be maintained with their baseline conditions and effectively cannot have any new or expanded activities that have the potential to change the water quality in any way. This applies even in situations where the activity meets current water standards and fully protects fish and other water uses, especially in the highly regulated industries that I represent. To be clear, the Clean Water Act, combined with other federal and state policy, intensively regulates how waters are managed and impacted by all user groups. Stringent water quality standards are established, baseline studies are performed, extensive monitoring takes place, and actions taken to further protect waters when needed. This management already exists in Alaska. A Tier 3 designation, however, goes much further than our already exemplary water quality protections without any added benefit to the environment, but without a threat to economic and community activities. Specifically, any activities that has the potential to degrade a designated Tier 2 water and its tributaries could be prohibited. This designation could impact users such as motorized vessels of any kind, residential and commercial septic systems, stormwater permits associated with road building, seafood processors, timber harvesting, and more. We also have concerns that a Tier 3 water designation has the potential to become a tool for anti-development interests to block or delay resource development projects. We believe that is evident in the five nominations currently before DEC, which specify that mining, oil and gas, federal land planning, and Alaska Native Corporation land selections are threats to water bodies. Further problematic is that a Tier 3 designation applies not just to the water itself, but to the tributary or the entire watershed that it touches. This is essentially comparable to establishing a de facto wilderness with capital W. Think of it as establishing a national park or other expansive conservation area. For this reason, we believe the authority to designate a Tier 3 water is of such importance that it should lie solely with the representatives of Alaska through the Alaska legislature. Because of the watershed-wide land and water impacts of a Tier 3 designation, it's no different than the impacts of the 12 million acres of already legislatively designated state refuges, sanctuaries, critical habitat areas, ranges, other special management areas, forests, parks, and the like. So to do so, to come in compliance, full compliance with what the EPA requires for these designations, the state needs to codify the statutory authority for DEC policy, which we understand has been in place for a number of years. So in short, this SB 72 is a housekeeping measure to implement and codify existing DEC policy. We believe enactment meets the EPA's Tier 3 designation process for compliance and would provide process and certainty to the public. Thank you for the opportunity to provide these abbreviated remarks to you today, and RDC testifies in support of SB 72.
Thank you for that accelerated testimony. Would you please send the full text of your script to our office and we'll distribute it to the full committee? And thank you. Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease and pass the gavel and get set up for our next presentation. Brief at ease.
2022 has been set aside. At this time, our speaker, the next subject is heavy oil recovery research. And our speaker is Dr. Dandekar from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Welcome, Dr. Dandekar, to the table. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Petroleum Engineering at the University of Alaska Fairbanks College of Engineering and Mines. So, Dr. Dandekar, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your presentation.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on heavy oil recovery research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And today I'm here to update on the progress that we have made so far on the $5 million state funding that we received for FY23 and FY24. For the record, my name is Abhijit Dandekar, and I'm professor and chair of petroleum engineering at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So the topics that I will cover during this presentation are outlined here. I'm going to begin with the vast heavy oil resources that we are all blessed with here in the state of Alaska and their significance, followed by the difficulties in producing them. And that's why this research. Our research over the last 5 years, and I'm referring to the DOE funded project, which I will talk about also in this presentation, that has provided sufficient evidence that polymer-enhanced oil recovery in the Alaskan Arctic works for what is known as viscous oils. So viscous oils are oils that are considered as water floodable. So you can inject water to recover viscous oils to some extent. And that was the primary motivation for ambitiously going after something even bigger in terms of the challenge as well as the prize. And now I'm referring to AGNU, which comes with its own baggage, so to speak. So on this slide, the leftmost picture shows the three main units on Alaska North Slope, the Prudhoe Bay unit, Kuparuk River unit, and the Milne Point unit. The viscous oils and heavy oils, they are basically sandwiched between Kuparuk and the permafrost, as you see on this particular slide. And that's basically our challenge, one of the challenges that we're dealing with when it comes to viscous oils. On the graph that is shown on the rightmost side, that's a graph that actually shows depth versus oil viscosity. So as you can see on that graph, as we get closer to the permafrost, the oil viscosity increases significantly. So as described on that slide, if you're talking about something like a light oil, then it's like water. Viscous oil is like syrup, and I would call it maple syrup. And heavy oil is like molasses or even honey that gets a little bit thick if you keep it on the shelf for a long time. Also shown on that graph are the three development stages, and as far as light oil is concerned, it's pretty well developed. Viscous oil is something that is developing. But now, after the research that we have done for the last 5 years, I'm more confident in saying that it is also partly developed. Possible future developments are AGNU. And that is what we are going after as far as the target is concerned. And you can see the oil in place shown for both categories of oils, pretty large numbers here, very significant resource. So rather than lumping everything in a general sort of heavy oil category, which the industry uses, we use a homegrown term, which I already referred to earlier. And that homegrown term is we try to differentiate between these high viscosity oils. One, the better part of high viscosity, if you will, is the viscous oils. They're not that bad. Heavy oils are, we call them heavy for a reason, because they are much more significantly viscous than in terms of viscosity than viscous oils. So the numbers for oil viscosity are actually shown there, and in the core area in Agnew, we are looking at 2,000 plus centipoise. And just as a reference here, water has a viscosity of 1 centipoise. So you can imagine the contrast. So viscous and heavy oils, they represent about a third of known North Slope original oil in place. And cumulative production of viscous and heavy oils is a fairly small number, about 1%, maybe a little bit more than that now, slope-wide. And currently, there is not much production from Agnew. It is producing about, if I look at the AOGCC database, it is producing from S2031 of the wells, about 300, 400 barrels per day, pretty small number. So why is heavy oil and the recovery research significant? So as you can see here, besides the first three obvious points about the strategic importance and local technology development and the large resource base, another constraint that we have is the transportation of that heavy oil through the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. TAPS still carries about 50% of it, maybe even more than that, light, what we call diluent oil, Prudhoe Bay type of oil. And we want to make use of that light oil as a diluent to ease the transport of heavy oil through TAPS. And there's much talk about Willow. Willow is a fairly light oil, and hopefully that comes on stream, then we'll be in a really good position. So why is it difficult to produce heavy oils? And I should have brought the samples with me. question?
Senator Bishop? Doctor, they've all seen it. I've got your samples from when I toured your lab in my office, so we've all got to touch it.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Thank you. So I'm showing here just the pictures of the two oils. One is viscous and the other one is heavy oil. So the primary obstacle, as I mentioned, for producing these oils is viscosity, also known as resistance to flow, if you will. Okay. So if we look at the 300 plus centipoise viscous oil, which is in the second tube from the top, and if you tilt the tube, then the oil does move. But if you do the same tilting of the tube as far as the heavy oil is concerned, that's the one in the topmost test tube, Agnew oil 2000 plus centipoise, it does move, but the movement is so sluggish. And you can imagine putting this oil in the porous rocks and trying to recover them. I mean, that is what we are faced with as far as the challenge in producing them is concerned. So these oils are in close proximity to the permafrost, and that's the reason we have high viscosities. The reservoir pressures are fairly low, so we're talking about 1,500, 1,600 PSI. They're lacking lighter components or gaseous components, lighter hydrocarbon components, and that is also the reason why they are high viscosity oils. And if you look at California or Canada for that matter, thermal recovery methods, if you go to Bakersfield area, everywhere you'll see steam being injected because they don't have to worry about the permafrost, which we have to worry.
Any questions at this point, members of the committee?
I'd just like to.
Senator Bishop.
Doctor, the permafrost, can you fact check what I'm going to say? Just to give you an idea how deep the permafrost is, I think it's about a quarter of a mile, 2,500 feet.
Thank you for your question, Senator Bishop, and to the chair. The continuous permafrost, I think I'm not a permafrost expert, I must admit, but we are talking about something like 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet, something like that. And it varies, I think, depending on where you are. Yeah, so that would be my response to your question. And related to that, the depth for these resources, we're talking about 3,000 feet and plus, if you will. So there is a spacing, if you will, as far as the permafrost is concerned. So it goes up to 2,000 feet, if you will, in terms of depth. And also, just to give you another point of reference here, is the reservoir temperatures for these viscous oil reservoirs as well as heavy oil reservoirs. It is about 75 degrees Fahrenheit, which is probably the temperature in the room right now. So pretty cold. Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator Bishop?
Yep.
Thank you. So moving on to an illustration that I have used pretty much in every heavy oil presentation that I have given so far. I don't know. I lost count. And that illustration is something that shows the concept of what is called as sweep efficiency, or a concept of mobility ratio. So just to put it in simple terms, the oil is very immobile, so to speak, relatively immobile. If you inject water, if you inject gas, that is going to move fast. And that results in, as you can see from the top picture there, that results in what we call viscous fingering. So the water will just create a finger through, and once it creates a finger through, it breaks through in your production well, then kind of game is over, so to speak. So that's the concept that is called as mobility ratio and sweep efficiency. Also shown on the right-hand side there is I'm showing just a beaker full of water, one centipoise. Now, if we mix that water with the polymer, that's what we have been using, and that's what we are also using now in this particular research, then depending on the concentration of the polymer that you add to the water, so just to give you an idea here, how much polymer are we talking about? What sort of concentration? So we are talking about anywhere between, let's say, 1,200 to about 1,700 parts per million. And if we do that, if you look at the polymer solution picture there, so if we do that, then we are able to achieve a viscosity of polymer solution anywhere between, let's say, 20 to about 40 or so centipoise. So we get a jump from 1 centipoise to 20, 30, 40 centipoise. Now that solution, and you can probably see on that picture there, my student is trying to pour the polymer solution in another container, and it's kind of, you know, a jelly-ish type of looking consistency. It's very sluggish in terms of flow. Now you're injecting that, and that would give you a better sweep. So when it comes to polymer, technically speaking, there are issues that we also need to worry about. And when I say issues that we need to worry about is, now you increase the viscosity of that water to 30, 40 centipoise, can you even inject that into the pore spaces? So that is something that was one of the big worries that we had 5 years ago. But now I can confidently tell you that, yes, we have proven that it does work. So there were no injectivity issues, at least in the viscous oil JPEG pilot that we did. Now, are there other concerns related to heavy oil recovery? Yes, plenty of them. And these are shown here on the slide. So first one is what is called as polymer retention. So simply speaking, what retention means is the amount of polymer that sticks to the rock or is retained by the rock. So if it is retained by the rock, then it is not really playing a role in your displacement efficiency, if you will. So we've got to worry about the retention, which could be a significant parameter as far as the effectiveness of a polymer fluid is concerned. Then when it comes to using any type of solvent, and that is what this project is about, polymer alternating solvent. So we are looking at injecting a hydrocarbon solvent, which is miscible with the heavy oil, so that we can bring down the viscosity of the Agnew oil, which is 2,000 plus centipoise, as I mentioned. One of the potential problems, as you can see in the figure on the top right corner, is precipitation of what is called as asphaltenes. So asphaltenes, in terms of appearance, they are a little bit like if you take coal and make a powder out of it. Those are the particles that we are talking about. And if they precipitate, they're going to block the pore spaces, and then that's going to be another challenge that you have to deal with. And that is something that we call formation damage. So formation is the rock. If it gets damaged, then that's another challenge to deal with. There are also concerns related to the breakthrough polymer. So in the JPAD pilot that we conducted over the last 4.5 years, in that particular pilot, there was no polymer breakthrough, i.e. the polymer showing up in your producer. There was no breakthrough for almost 26 to 28 months. So it stayed in the reservoir, but eventually it did show up. It is going to show up someday. Now the problem is, when that shows up in your production stream, then that's going to take part, if you will, or influence what we call emulsions. And if you have emulsions, yeah, you may have produced extra oil, but then you've got to break those emulsions. So that's another problem. The other one shown by the stainless steel tube that we see in the second picture, that is what we call the polymer-induced fouling. So it's a little bit like, you know, if you take a kettle to boil water, the scale that develops, and if that develops, and polymer, if it actually fouls the tube, then it forms like a molten plastic, if you will, and that is something that impacts the overall heat transfer coefficient, so it defeats the purpose of using heat-treaters. The other one is, lastly, something we call conformance control. So what does conformance mean? Conformance basically means is the injection of polymer is something that is taking place over long horizontal wells, which are about a mile long. So how do we make sure that the polymer solution actually is injected sort of evenly, if you will, throughout that mile-long length? So each of them, they have what is called as ICDs in short, or injection control devices. So they're like nozzles. So conformance, what that actually means is, if there is one particular ICD taking a lot of polymer solution and others are not taking any, then we got to do something, and that something that we've got to do is conformance control to make sure that it's evenly injected. We are not showing here on this slide, but just a side point that I would like to make is, we also investigated recovering the breakthrough polymer. So yes, polymer breaks through, but can we actually recover some of that polymer? So we are not going to recover the polymer in its original form, but we are going to get the polymer in the form of, you know, viscosified water, if you will, produced water. But one thing that I will mention here is, the polymer, once it goes through the reservoir rock and is produced, then it gets what is called as sheared, so it breaks down, mechanically breaks down, chemically breaks down, and that breakdown actually reduces the viscosity of the polymer. But still, even if we are able to get like 4 centipoise, 5 centipoise produced water viscosity, we can use that to do the makeup solution. So I'm going to move on to the success of the Schrader Bluff pilot, and I kind of alluded to in the previous slides. Shown on the top here is the polymer injection unit that is used in the JPAD in Milne Point Field. And the two pictures at the bottom, they show the details of the lines and the pumps that are actually used. So the idea here is fairly simple. in the sense that it does look complicated, but fairly simple idea-wise, is you prepare what is called as a mother solution. So mother solution is you add a lot of polymer and make really, really thick solution, and then you dilute it according to the required concentration. So that is all done in the polymer injection unit. So the polymer, I've been mentioning polymer so many times. What kind of polymer do we actually inject? So the polymer that's injected is called as hydrolyzed polyacrylamide. So it, if you look at it, and you probably saw that in that picture that I showed earlier, it looks like sugar. So the team was able to visit the J-pad, as you can see in the top picture. So we had a lot of delays due to COVID and other things. So moving on to the benefit that we got, the enhanced oil recovery benefit that we got from the J-pad pilot. So this slide actually gives you an idea of the actual rate of polymer flood compared with what is called as the best case history matched model. So the history match is you take production data and calibrate your simulation models, because that's the only way you can do the forecast. So we are looking at the incremental recovery of about 700 barrels of oil per day even now, compared to if we had just water flooded that pattern, which is not very efficient in terms of recovery. Another measure of success that we use is what is called as polymer utilization factor. So I've been talking about, you know, how great the polymer is. So how much polymer do we need to produce that incremental barrel of oil? So the number shown here is about 1.7 pounds of polymer per incremental barrel. A pound of polymer, there are costs available for that, ballpark estimate. So we're looking at maybe $2, $3 per pound. So we're not looking at a whole lot of cost in terms of producing that incremental barrel. And also I would say that this is one of the lowest, I would say, reported in the literature, polymer utilization factor, if I compare that with all the other polymer floods that have taken place in the world elsewhere. So we have also done some forecast and economic analysis, as shown on this particular slide here. And I already talked about history matching, so I won't repeat that here. But we are comparing basically a performance of water flood, which is not very efficient, with the performance of a polymer flood. So we are forecasting it out to year 2050. And if you look at the comparison of the blue curves with all the other curves, especially the ones, the red one, which is the best model, but even if I look at the most conservative model, which is the gray curves that you see, we are still looking at producing anywhere between 1.6 to 1.7 times the water flood recovery. And in the economic analysis that we did, the bar chart shows that economic analysis for those history matched models, and we're comparing net present value, profit to investment ratio, and development cost, etc. All three models, they remain robustly profitable over the period of forecast going all the way to 2050. So workforce development is something that is an important component of our research. And I'm showing a picture very proudly of a student, Cody Keith, who is a 100% Alaskan kid. I still call him kid. So he worked, he's the one who ran all those simulations, and he won the Society of Petroleum Engineers Western Region Student Paper Contest, beating all the top class schools. I won't name them, and you probably guess who those are on the West Coast. And then he competed internationally. That is where he also won the first place, beating everybody from all over the world in the master's division, I must say. That's a great, you know, achievement, and we're really proud of that. So Cody is actually working for ConocoPhillips as a reservoir surveillance engineer, and he is still our, I guess, contact, if you will, in ConocoPhillips, even though we know a lot of other people, but kind of hopefully promote also polymer on the West Sac side of the viscous oil. So targeting the Agnew, and that is what this polymer alternating solvent technology is, or the method that we are researching is. So can polymer alone work in Agnew? I mentioned injectivity issues. So we may not be able to inject polymer given the high viscosity of Agnew compared to much high compared to viscous oils in Schrader block. So our proposed solution is what is known as polymer alternating solvent. So idea is to use a solvent to reduce the viscosity of Agnew oil and then do polymer. So coming to the management of this project, and as I mentioned, we are into sixth or seventh month of this particular research that started the funding in FY23. We have basically retained the structure of the previous project, which we know worked very well over the last 4.5 years. There are experts that we have retained from New Mexico Tech, Missouri S&T, and Dr. Ning is working with us from Hillcorp side as a consultant. And the UF personal team is listed there. And we meet every other Friday for 2 hours, 3 hours, brainstorm on ideas on how are we progressing and how can we improve what we are doing. So that is what has been happening as far as project management is concerned. And Senator Bishop, thank you very much for visiting us in January, early January. Unfortunately, I missed that visit. And you are most welcome again and again to visit our labs. And I extend that invitation to the entire Senate Resource Committee to visit our labs and see what we are doing, participate in our meetings even. So that would be, we will really welcome that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the approach that we are taking here in this polymer alternating solvent project. So this differs somewhat from the DOE funded project in the JPAD, in the sense that the JPAD right from day one started as a field laboratory because a pattern was readily available and it was just the right opportunity to use polymer injection because that pattern was actually water flooded previously for about 2 years, and the performance, poor performance of water flood recovery was documented. So this was a perfect opportunity. DOE funding came, Hillcorp was ready, we were ready, perfect combination of government, industry, and academia. But polymer alternating solvent is a new territory for us, and that's why we are doing this particular research. So we need to first demonstrate that it does work efficiently in the lab, and then after that, if we know that it does work in the lab, if we can simulate it properly through a numerical reservoir simulation, then we can embark on the field testing of this concept. So I'm going to show you some latest results here in the next few slides, and then I'll come to the end of my presentation. So on the first picture here, we are looking at the interaction between carbon dioxide, which is also one of the solvent that we are testing. And there is much talk about CCUS these days everywhere, even in Alaska. So it's something that's natural for us to test to see how CO2 actually impacts the Agnew oil. So this is the real Agnew oil. And if I could back up just for a minute here, when it comes to commitment from the industry, so we have samples from Agnew, we have reservoir rock samples, we have the NGL, natural gas liquid samples. From the field, we have reservoir data and also advisory. So it is that Agnew sample that we are testing here. So if you see at the beginning of the test, if you look at the top of the first image, you see it's colorless. That's basically CO2, just brought in contact with oil. And then at the end of the test, see what happens in that sapphire window. It becomes completely dark. And that completely dark means that that CO2 has now dissolved, is now dissolved into the oil, and it swells the oil, which we call swelling factor. So if you're able to swell the oil as heavy as Agnu, then that is basically what we're looking for. Also shown on the graph there is the effect of CO2 on viscosity of oil, and you can see pretty significant reduction in the viscosity, and that is what we are actually aiming for. And of course, we are awaiting the samples for natural gas liquids. That's something that we're going to test also, and hopefully next time when I'm here, I'll show those pictures as well, how the heavy oil, Agnu oil, interacts with NGL. So we have been running what is called as commercial sand pack experiments. So sand pack basically means you buy commercial sand, put it in what is called as a core holder, saturate that with heavy oil, saturate that with water, inject the water, inject the polymer, inject the solvent. Those are sand pack experiments. So we are able to recover some of that heavy oil with just water. But something that you should notice here is if we inject polymer solution after water, we are able to produce even more heavy oil. Okay. So it does work, but these heavy oil recoveries that you see here, they are high. And the reason they are high is because they are in commercial sand packs, which have very high porosities and permeabilities. So the real test is going to be when we do this experiment in a real reservoir sand. That's the next thing. So as I mentioned in the previous slide, two slides back, I showed the interaction of carbon dioxide with heavy oil. So we are conducting experiments on CO2 and then alternate that CO2 with water injection. So that is not actually polymer alternating solvent right now, at least in this stage, but it is water alternating solvent, if you will. So CO2 is the solvent that we have used, and as shown by the schematic here, we are currently experimenting what is called as a huff and puff. So huff and puff means you inject the solvent, lock the system, and then let the solvent soak into the oil and then produce the well back. So that's called the huff and puff, or solvent soak, if you will. The CO2 slugs, as they're referred to, that we inject. So what kind of slugs are we injecting? So we're not injecting a whole lot of CO2, a little bit of CO2 just to see the effect. So this is going to be a very long sort of iterative process to figure out that exact combination. So here is a picture, just to kind of follow up on the previous slide. This depicts the soaking modes that we have tested. So these are the results from last week. So they're pretty new, sort of hot off the press results. So in the first one, a certain slug of CO2 is injected, and we allow some oil to be produced, and then close the system, or lock the system, so let the CO2 soak, and then follow that with water injection to see the soaked CO2, how much viscosity it has reduced, and then we can recover the heavy oil. In the second stage, there is what we call full soak. So full soak means inject CO2, achieve a certain pressure, and then close the system, and then follow that up with water again. Idea is to figure out exactly what sort of combination polymer water in this particular case and CO2 or a solvent combination would be ideal. So the first set of images here, again, these are very, very recent results from last week. They show the cumulative oil production, and you can see at the bottom of that measuring cylinder, also water production. There is gas also produced, which is CO2 in this particular case, but the gas is something that we cannot see. It's measured by or seen by the gas meter that records how much gas we are producing. So in this, other motivation is to also figure out how much CO2 we are able to actually store in that heavy oil. And that kind of goes back to the CCUS that I was referring to earlier. The bar chart that's shown on the rightmost side is something that tells us that we are able to recover not a whole lot of heavy oil, only about 11% just with CO2. But then the most interesting is the recovery factor due to water that is injected after the CO2 contact. So definitely the CO2 has done its magic, so to speak, in reducing the viscosity of the heavy oil, and then we are able to recover as much as 43% oil just because of water, because of that reduction in the viscosity. After that, there was another full soak period, and then we tried to inject some more water to figure out if we can produce even more oil. Not a whole lot of oil was produced, about 4.9%, as you can see from that tiny red color bar chart, but nevertheless, it does show some production even after that in a what we call tertiary mode. So we are able to produce quite a lot of oil here. So bottom line, in terms of progress, we are where we should be at this time, given the circumstances. And one of the challenges that we, of course, face being in Fairbanks or in Alaska is getting chemicals and materials. Sometimes they take months. There is a chemical called normal heptane, which is used as a reagent that took 2 months to arrive because of supply issues, whatever the factors were. But in spite of that, we're doing our best with whatever we have. And the rest of the slide or the text on this slide should be self-explanatory. But we have a plan to actually have a two-day event, conference, if you will, forum, meeting of the minds, so to speak, at the end of May, where we are going to invite industry, we are going to invite the polymer manufacturer, SNF, and I would extend that invitation to you all as well. And we are going to do a brainstorm over 2 days to figure out, where we are, where we should go from here, kind of checking on our progress. So that's basically our plan in end of May. So this is going to take place right after the Society of Petroleum Engineers Western Regional Meeting, which also takes place here in Alaska after many, many years, is going to take place in Anchorage. So a lot of people are going to be there. We have also invited people from Canada, because Canada has done quite a lot of heavy oil work. So they will be there as well. So in closing, we are grateful to the United States Department of Energy for the Schrader Bluff results summary of the results that I showed. Hillcorp Alaska, they co-sponsored the JPAT polymer pilot. And thank you very much also to Governor Dunleavy, State of Alaska, for funding the polymer alternating solvent project. And we are confident that this would be another great state government industry academia partnership going forward. So on behalf of the entire team, I thank you very much for listening to me. And I will be happy to take any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dandekar. Very interesting. Any questions for the doctor? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question on the polymer itself. Is it something that industry has been designing? Is it something that we've designed here in Alaska, or is it something that's been designed from somewhere else, just tested here?
Thank you very much for the question, Senator Kawasaki, through Madam Chair. So polymer has been used. It's not new technology per se, conceptually as well as field application wise. China has been doing it for many, many years. Canada is another good example. And thank you for asking that question. In fact, the scale of the field pilot that we did here in Alaska, there has not been anything like that in the United States to that level. And that is the reason we, in fact, many of our publications, it starts with the first ever polymer field pilot in Alaska, Alaskan Arctic, and we say that in the United States. And going back to your question, as far as the polymer itself is concerned, so this is something that is actually manufactured by different companies, but SNF is the company that actually manufactures polymer. So the polymer actually comes all the way from Georgia. So it comes, gets barged, and then on the railroad, and then the haul road to the slope. So logistically, it's quite a bit of a challenge, and that's why I think perhaps I may not have mentioned it, but if you remember seeing the picture of that silo, so silo is something that can actually, you can store a whole lot of polymer, so you don't have to rely on those what we call super sacks, which have a limitation in terms of, you know, how much polymer can be loaded, etc. And so another, I guess, concept is, theoretically, is can we manufacture polymer here? Okay. So the raw material that is actually needed for manufacturing polymer is actually natural gas, so to speak, which we have a lot. But there are other, elements that are needed. They are not readily available here. So conceptually, yes. Anyway, long answer to your question. I don't know if I answered it.
Yeah, you did. Thanks. I have another question on the polymer itself. Thank you, Madam Chair. The polymer itself, it's fairly inert then? And then what happens to the polymer after you create a flooded zone with that in it? What happens to it?
Okay. Again, thank you for the great question, Senator Kawasaki, through Madam Chair. The polymer actually, if you recall one of the slides that I talked about, when the polymer breaks through, and the polymer breaks through means it shows up in your produced stream, if you will. So there was a lot of concern initially. On the slope, when it comes to treating the produced stream, initially, in terms of emulsion and the heat-treated fouling that I mentioned, but the amount of polymer that shows up, just to give you some numbers here to put them in perspective, for the JPAD, the breakthrough polymer concentration is about 600, 700, and in one of the producers is even 300 parts per million. So polymer stays in water. So it does not go into the oil phase. It stays in water, but it is processed. In the case of Milne Point unit, so it gets processed along with, so the trunk line that goes from the JPAD all the way to the central processing facility. So it gets processed, and then the separated water gets disposed of, and maybe some of it perhaps used for reinjection. And that's why we are also looking at recycling some of that polymer water, so it becomes like a closed system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Kleeman.
This is kind of similar about the CO2, because on our discussions about carbon credits, we've been talking about what to do with CO2. So in this instance, you're using, the concept would be use the CO2 you had injected into the heavy oil, and that would actually thin the heavy oil to make it easier to get out of the ground. What happens to the CO2 when I presume it comes out of the ground with the heavy oil, and now it's not as thick an oil. What happens to the CO2 after it comes out?
Again, thank you very much for your question, Senator Kleeman, through Madam Chair. CO2, so we have to evaluate. And in fact, when I say evaluate, that means, and I may have referenced that earlier in one of my slides, is with CO2 that we're injecting, we want to find out how much CO2 actually stays in the reservoir. So we have to do some calculations to give you a better answer in terms of you know, how much stays. But you're absolutely correct. Some of that CO2 is going to come back with the oil. And again, so in imagine a pipeline that's coming from one of these pads, if you will. That pipeline is going to contain some produced gas, some produced water, some oil, of course, and that will go into the central processing facility. So the gas is removed, and then that gas, potentially, it could be used to used as a recycle gas, if you will. And in fact, there are some ideas that I have is, rather than getting all that recycling from the central processing facility, that recycling could be done on the pad itself. If you have a small sort of, knockout drum, that's the terminology that's actually used. Knockout drum would actually knock out the water, and then you could use the water-containing polymer to recycle. You could do the same thing with the CO2. So it becomes like a closed system. And once you reach a point where, okay, a lot of CO2 is showing up, then, you know, something else needs to be done at that moment. So does that answer your question?
Just one
follow-up, Senator Clement.
So just by when the CO2 goes into the heavy oil, it seems to get soaked into the heavy oil, but you're saying that after that initial soaking, later as it came out of the ground, some of that CO2 would actually come out. It wouldn't all stay in solution with the heavy oil.
That is correct. Again, thank you for your follow-up question, Senator Clement, through Madam Chair. So, yes, some of that CO2 is going to come back. It's a little bit like, you know, we do gas injection in Prudhoe Bay has been doing gas injection for so many years. You inject gas, and some of that gas still comes out. So it's inevitable. Thank you.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about how this will affect the blend. You mentioned before that, you know, with other supply coming on, that it'll help maintain, like the sulfur content. I know I worked on the Whiting refinery upgrades to handle the crude coming out of the tar sands, and boy, we had to bump up the sulfur handling capacity, and you know, it was quite the deal. So I'm just wondering about this sulfur content, sour. How will it affect the blend in those respects?
Thank you for your question, Senator Kaufman, through Madam Chair. As far as I know, there is not a H2S concern, especially with the heavy oil. Generally, our crudes, I would say, are sweet, as we refer to in terms of terminology. They're not sour crudes. So I'm, in fact, looking at a positive side of it in the sense that and that positive side is, if you take that heavy oil from Agnew and add Prudhoe Bay oil to it and shake it for some time, and you can see the effect. So I'm looking at the positive side of it. But H2S, to answer your question, is not really a big concern. Does that answer your question, concern? Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Dr. Dandekar. Thank you for your work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, our Arctic University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, with that, it concludes our meeting for today. The next meeting will be Monday, March 20th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda will be Senate Joint Resolution 8, National Park Service Hunting in Preserves. And we will also take under consideration the governor's appointees with public testimony. So at this time, we are adjourned. The time is 4:54 p.m.